My name is Clancy Imeslin, and I'm an alcoholic. A little sorry that the applause was not sustained enough for me to get to the podium. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I made a tremendous sacrifice to be with you. I really did. I was having lunch today with Lou Holtz, Notre Dame football coach, and SC football coach, and a guy named Paul Horning, and Cardinal Mahoney, and at a big SC Notre Dame football luncheon in Los Angeles before the big game tomorrow. It really was fascinating. We were telling jokes and having a great time, and a lot of old Heisman Award winners there, and everybody's doing good. And I finally had to excuse myself because I had to go catch a plane to the South Bay Group. They begged me to stay, but I said no. They need me. But I'm glad to be here, and I want to thank Jim and Yolanda for picking me up at the airport. Lately, when I'm coming to Northern California, the chances are about 1 in 3 someone's ever going to meet me at the airport. It's just ridiculous. I always have my rental card with me just in case. But tonight everything was fine, and I'm pleased to be here. And before I start off tonight, there's something I have to tell you. I also have another mission in life that I go through life with this. It's a kind of a cold and lonely job, and it's not much appreciated, but someone's got to do it, and I've taken on that responsibility. About 25 or 26 years ago, in the Canoga Park Group in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles, there was an old guy named Bill Davidson, or Bill D, as he was known, and he was kind of an old curmudgeon, and he was a kind of a tradition fanatic, and he felt no one in AA should be well known, not even known in their group, I guess. And yeah, I guess he thought if you just all sit in a circle and be anonymous. And what he used to do, when they'd read the traditions at that meeting, he would join in the end, and he'd say, "Principles before personalities." They'd say, "Oh, for Christ's sake, Bill, knock it off. I'm not going to knock it off. It needs to be said." So after a while, some of the young guys in the group really were kind of amused by this old fool, so they would join in and mock him and say it, which was fine. That went on for a while, except one day, apparently, someone from another group came in, heard this, and thought it was some sort of a spiritual breakthrough, and took it back to their group. And then for about 20 years, there was just a little cluster of about 6 groups in the San Fernando Valley where they would join in and say principles before personalities and look smug. Then somehow the virus got loose, and now it's around a lot of meetings in Southern California. None of the meetings I go to, I'm glad to say. But I heard it tonight. And not only that, but I heard you join in the end of Chapter 5, for which there's no rationale for. So I just want you to know, the next time you gather together and you smugly say, "Principles before personalities," you're not being spiritual. You're just mocking poor old Bill Davidson in the Canoga Park. You don't have to like it, but it's the truth. Don't let it frighten you. I used to drink alcohol, like most of us, I guess. Young people back here who are addicts, you are certainly welcome to our open meetings, but to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you must be an alcoholic. It's one of the problems of it's been over the years, and it's not because we don't like narcotics addicts. It's because the primary problem in Alcoholics Anonymous, the primary problem amongst alcoholics, the terrible feeling of being different. And the one thing that sets this fellowship aside from all other fellowships over the world is it's one talking to another to help break down that feeling of difference, which is incidentally why special interest groups never succeed. Rarely, if ever, you'd think they would, that a group made up entirely of actors, a group made up entirely of doctors, or a group made up entirely of pilots, and they succeed for a little while, but unless they get into the main population of AA, they don't last because of a very simple reason. All of us come here feeling different. When I join with other people, that I can say, yes, we are different because we are apart from them because of this reason, I reinforce the feelings of difference. And that's why it is a continual lack of success. So that's why members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who also used narcotics in the late 1950s, formed Narcotics Anonymous. And that is why members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who also had compulsive eating problems, founded Overeaters Anonymous in 1960. And that's why members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who were also gamblers, founded Gamblers Anonymous in 1959. And that's why members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who were also cocaine addicts, founded Cocaine Anonymous in the 1970s. I know the founders of all these groups. They all are very dedicated people, but they realize that no matter what you say about it, as much as I want to be empathetic, I don't identify with the person telling me about his gambling problem if I don't have a gambling problem. That's all. It has to do with the recovery. I remember thinking about that a few years ago, 1960. I was about two years sober, and they founded this Overeaters Anonymous. And they came up with the AA club to get volunteers to speak at their first meeting, so they had no successes, much old fat broad sitting around. And, well, some of them were moving, I don't know. I don't know why I'm never invited back anywhere. I haven't said anything yet back there, so it's all right. So they invited me to come over and talk on obsessions. And I was just 2 years sober, and I'm an authority on obsessions, not how to overcome them. And I don't know, they're not going to have a good talk on obsessions. That's maybe the second or third speaker OA ever had. I weighed about 130 pounds as a skinny, scrawny. And I tried to help them. And then I sat down, and they start talking about their problem. And I couldn't believe my ears. You know, I know a lot about obsessions, but this one woman, you know, talks about eating two cakes. And I thought, you really are a sick bitch, you know. Some woman talks about eating and eating till she couldn't eat anymore and going to the washroom and putting her finger down her throat and then coming back and eating some more. I thought, I don't even want to shake hands with you, you know. I can see doing that about drinking, but not eating, you know. And it's much that same way. That is why AA is so specific in its traditions. You must be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. In case there's any question, there's a little folder called Problems Other Than Alcohol, written by Bill Wilson, which he specifically says, unless you are an alcoholic, you cannot be a participating member of Alcoholics Anonymous, despite what someone in your local group may tell you, because it's the identification. I don't know if I ever mentioned this before or not. I don't know, I'm in kind of a free fall tonight. About 2 years before I went to speak at OA, I was sober about a month. I was living in the back seat of an abandoned car back at the AA club. And I was a scruffy-looking puke. Had no front teeth and grubby old clothes and dreadful attitude and skinny and goofy. And UCLA, big hospital in Los Angeles, came to the AA club and asked for 10 volunteers, 10 known alcoholics. Even though I didn't feel like one, I volunteered. They wanted 10 volunteers because the University of Saskatchewan had isolated a chemical that would help alcoholics get to the root of their inner self and really make the breakthrough that allowed them to get a perception of their problem. And they had they're running this big test, and they'd give you a room, and they'd give you meals, they'd give you clothing, and take care of you for 2 weeks, 3 weeks while you took these chemicals to see if they worked. And I volunteered. I didn't care about the chemicals, but I only got out of that abandoned car. It was getting cold. And they looked at me, and they turned me down. I guess I looked so bad that they thought I wouldn't give their damn chemical a fair shake. And so I missed the famous 1958 UCLA test of the new drug called LSD. And 8 of those people are dead. And that was a wonderful... There's always breakthroughs. Nobody's always got a better idea. You know, as long as I can remember, there's always been somebody's got a better way than AA. There's always got somebody better way than AA. If you pardon me, I'm off on a tangent tonight, but what do you care? It's holding up the drawing, you can win a weekend with Duffy. I had lunch with Duffy today. He was at that very lunch and I sat at my table, and I somehow was thinking about those OAs in 1960. Don't let it go out of this room. But over the years, there's been a lot of great cures for alcoholism since I've been sober. In fact, they've always looked for the reason for alcoholism. You know, there's always been the feeling if we could just find out what it is. And there have been some theories in the early 1950s, before I was sober. They thought it was a malfunctioning of the endocrine or ductless glands that it would process alcohol in the body differently. It turned out that wasn't it, because they could disprove it. But after that, I wish I'd known that, because in the 1950s, I was in bad shape. coming home drunk and sitting on the front porch in the snow and vomit, my wife came out the porch saying, "And you and little children in the house, and you sit out here and vomit, and the neighbors can see you. What kind of a sick pervert are you?" It would be nice to be able to say, I have a malfunctioning of my endocrine receptors. Except that wouldn't have stopped her. When I was sober about 7 years, I was working for a big television station in Hollywood. And then a guy came down and gave a talk at our station. He was on a tour, and he was the director of the Schick Shadel Alcoholism Institute in Seattle. And their theory at that time was that alcoholics could return to social drinking if it was caused by an imbalance of enzymes. If they could redress the enzyme imbalance, the alcoholic could drink. And I went down there just to, I didn't believe it, but I went down there to listen to him. I stood behind the camera and watched his interview. And this guy was a bad alcoholic, apparently. He said he was. And he got all done with this enzyme story, and he wound up by picking up a martini and saying, "They would have you believe that you can't do this." And I didn't want to drink, but my tongue darted out. And I was wondering, I wonder if they have any enzymes down at the 7-Eleven. But about a month later, this guy, in the later part of his tour, apparently his enzymes did not kick in at the right time, and he wound up in a padded cell at Schick Shadel. And since then, they have they've changed their philosophy to, it now takes a week to cure you. But there's in Los Angeles, big hospital, big Seventh-day Adventist hospital in outside of Los Angeles, very famous, had a two-page, full pages in the Los Angeles Times in the 1970s. I remember reading this. Now, Seventh-day Adventists are deaf on drinking, but they wanted to help alcoholics. So they took one of the wards of the hospital and turned it to a regular old bar, just a regular bar with pictures on the wall of the bar. And these poor boobs would come in there sick and off the streets. Their family turned them in and come in the morning. And there's a bartender standing there. "All right, pal, do you want a little drink?" "Yeah, what do you serve it? Some kind of medicine?" "No, scotch, rum, bourbon. What do you want?" I can't believe it." "Well, believe it." "Oh, I'll try some bourbon." "Okay, partner." Had little glasses, little wires on them, I guess, so they couldn't take them out of the bar. So they got, and it was good bourbon. "My God, you Seventh-day Adventists know how to treat alcoholics, huh?" And for days, you come every morning, "What do you want?" "A little bourbon." "One more." "You bet." "Great." Then one day the bad news came. As he took a drink of bourbon, they ran an electric shock through this cord. That's what it was for. You go, "No ice this time, Fred. Then after that, then they'd give him a drink without the shock. And after that, after all, the guy was just, he's like a fawn in the forest fire. So finally, the guy came in the morning and said, "You want a little drink?" He says, "Christ, no, I don't want a drink." And if he did that 3 mornings, they had another cure. And they had 100% cures. The guys got out of the hospital. And they had big article in the paper. And finally, some months later, somebody did a follow-up, and none of these people were sober. Because they walked out sober. The first bar they found without any wires on the glasses. And then if you're old, you remember the 1970s, the RAND report. Most very famous, made papers all over the world. RAND is top think tank in Santa Monica. "Alcoholics can drink again, safely." And then small type, it says, "Except those that can." But they proved their research that alcoholics could drink again if it, and that made front pages of every paper in the world. And 2 or 3 years later, some doctor in Australia did a follow-up on them. And they were all drunk. Some of them did. And I knew a guy in the RAND Corporation who was an AA. I said, "Jesus, how did they do that follow-up? How could they say they were sober if they weren't?" "I don't know. I'll check it out." He came back a week later, and we had a laugh about it. He said, "What they did, they would have this control group, then call them every month and see how they were doing. You just see some guy, still okay." There was a doctor in Albuquerque in the early 1980s. He had a technique where if you got really drunk and crazy, you'd go to his office, they'd bring you to his office, and he'd take films of you. And then the next time you were sober and felt like drinking, you'd go over and watch this film and see how sickening you got, and you wouldn't want to drink. And that worked for a little while until they didn't have time to stop by the theater on the way to the bar, you know. There's been all sorts of ways and new ways and better ways. And here we are tonight in San Jose, and this is still the only thing that has ever worked on a regular basis for people like you and me. Still, the world is full of people who fight it, and especially people like you and me who fight it. And I fought it most of my adult life, and I didn't fight it because I was against AA. I fought it for the same reason everybody else that I know of fights it, because I always knew my case was different. It's a different. It's easy for you to laugh. You have no idea what it's like. Now I've lost my place, I'll have to start over again. Hi, my name is Clancy. That's trouble with these memorized talks. But I drank a lot in my life, and I never really felt that alcohol was a big problem in my life. Although I got in a lot of problems with it. I got in jails. I went to jail many times. I was hospitalized. I was strapped down. But I never really felt that alcohol was a problem. I always felt alcohol is a, to them, it looks like a problem. But to me, my problems are considerably more complex than drinking. My problems are feelings that I have inside of me, and the way people treat me, and the way I'm screwed around my life a lot, and the way things don't work out, and on and on. And drinking makes me overcome those feelings. And sometimes I drink too much, and then well-meaning people think my problem is alcohol, but I know it is. When they tell me I'll be all right if I stop drinking, I know they don't understand. I used to spend a lot of time over the years examining myself. I felt if I've ever been given any gift by life, it was a gift of self-analysis. I didn't want to waste this gift, if you've been given that gift, I want to give you some hope. You will never have a good day as long as you live. You may have good mornings for a while. Pretty nice morning. I wonder why. But over the years, I had a lot of feelings, you know. And I can joke about them now, but I really couldn't identify them at the time. I know there's a lot of new people here tonight who don't know much about AA. A lot of people here from Monterey who don't know much about AA. I didn't mean anything personal, guys. Yes, I did. But the problem that a great many new people have is that you hear the speakers talk, and they always have such nicely packaged talks. And then in 1952 I did this, then in 1954 I realized this, then 1956, and it's just wonderful. I'll tell you, it isn't that way when you're living through it. It's just, remember a few years ago I took my little boy to Gettysburg. I'm kind of a Civil War buff. He was about 11. I took him to the battlefield of Gettysburg, and I gave him probably a definitive and explicit explanation of that battle that anybody ever had. I just pointed out to him where the Union troops had started, where they were pushed back to this hill, and why, where General Meade brought up some guys, and on this hill was Lee, and on the second day he sent Hood and some other troops up to enfilade through Emmitsburg Road. The third day they had 15,000 Pickett's guys, and they brought in, I gave about an hour and a half on this battle, and I finally looked down, and the kid was going, you certainly know a lot about the Battle of Gettysburg, don't you, Dad? I said, yes, I do, kid. I know more than anybody who fought in it. Oh, I see. But I thought later, that's exactly true. I know more about the Battle of Gettysburg than anybody who fought in it, because I knew what everybody was thinking. None of them knew what everybody was thinking. I knew what everybody was thinking, what they're trying to do. The people who fought in the battle, they just said, oh, shit, here they come again. And that's much the way it is with life, you know. We get up and talk knowledgeably about our lives as though we knew what was going on. What was going on is just, oh, shit, here they come again. But over the years I've been sober, I've talked a lot about feelings, but I suppose to make it a little more succinct, I could maybe three general areas in which I had a lot of feelings but could not really identify them until after I got sober. I could identify them but not understand the ramifications. One was that for a reason I never could figure out why, and I couldn't put my finger on what the feeling was until I heard somebody tell it to me in the fifth step once, in his own fifth step. But it just seemed to me all my life, it seemed like other people felt there was something wrong with me, but nobody ever told me what it was. It's almost as though they all seem to like each other better than they like me. Nothing that I could lay my finger on, but it always seemed that way. I didn't quite fit in, and I wasn't quite enough. And that was a feeling I had a lot, not being enough. And I learned as a young guy, the way you overcome that, I wasn't aware I was doing it. You learn some little dog and pony show. You learn some little gimmick. You learn some little defense mechanism that keeps them at bay. And it turned, I thought I was the only one in the world who had to hide myself from people. I find out later that everybody does. That's what defense mechanisms are, and all human beings have them to one form or another. But some of them need them more than others. And one of the ones that I used to, that helped me a lot was, I've always done a lot of reading. I used to be something of a writer. Most of my life, was building life as a writer. And I'd use what, you know, as the, what I always thought of as the imitation intellectual defense, you know. What we've been arguing about, I don't suppose you have any idea what Nietzsche had to say about that, do you? No, I didn't think you did. And there's millions of these little things. You get all the way to the other end of the spectrum. It looks entirely different. It looks entirely different, but it's exactly the same thing. The guy who says, I got a new Harley. I'm going to drive it up your ass. But they're all saying, in effect, is this. Stay at a distance and believe what I show you. Don't look and see that I'm not enough. So I always had that feeling. I was trying to cover for that feeling. I had a lot of fear in my life. A lot of fear that, I know everybody has a lot of fear, but the thing that I could not identify exactly is that my fear seemed to become more intense when I became successful. I always thought fear should go away when you become successful. But I'd work my butt off to get a fairly good job again, be doing good. And all it would take to trigger that fear and terror is to have someone start criticizing me or my job or what I was doing. And then all of a sudden, it's just they're trying to ruin everything for me. I want to get them and get into a battle over it. It's overreact constantly. And that sort of thing always leads to your own demise. Feeling I had a lot was that for some reason I could never understand what I could feel. It always seems to me I've been too vulnerable to feelings. Other people seem to be able to take feelings in stride, but I just seem to, they just seem to get to me. I heard a guy say one time, he said, well, for Christ's sake, kid, you can't do anything about the bullet with your name on it, and you can't do it about the emotional arrow with your name on it. When it's going to get you, it's going to get you. I thought about that later. I thought, that may be true. But there's a lot of arrows out there addressed to whom they may concern. And I'm getting more than my share of it. And the net result of that is I spent much of my life with hurt feelings. I don't know if you identify that, but my feelings were always hurt. We were talking about it at dinner tonight, about having your feelings hurt and walking home, you know, freezing your butt off to prove that you were right about it. I don't know if you ever did that. When I was new in AA, I walked. Somebody hurt my feelings at the meeting, the guy that gave me the ride there. And I said, I don't need your ride home, thanks. He said, gee, you have nowhere to get there. Don't worry about me. And I walked about seven miles, I thought. Why did I say that? You know. But I did it all my life. I worked in a big corporation once where I had a great job, and the guy hurt my feelings on a bad day criticizing something I'd written. And I said, if that's the way it is, why don't you get yourself another boy? And they did. God damn it. And my wife never stopped reminding me of that for 20 years. Want me to get another boy today? And the bad thing about that feeling is that you, when your feelings are hurt and you always have to be something different, you can slide into a frame of reference without even being aware of it. And I've done it a lot. And I may do it today sometime, but I don't think so. But where it looks as though everybody can just be what they are. You can just be what you are. But I have to keep pretending. I have to keep making adjustments. I have to keep playing a role to get along. Everybody else can just be what they are, and that's fine. I'm the only one who's got to play a role all the time. And damn, I'm sick of it. And these feelings and a lot of other feelings have bubbled intermittently in my life, and other kinds of things, and hurt feelings, and wanting things to be right, and they're never right, and people screwing me around, and on and on. And I was a young man. I went into psychoanalysis because I wanted to become successful. I wanted to get these terrible feelings out of the way. I guess, you know, they say you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis. Maybe you shouldn't today, but I think psychoanalysis has been ruined over the years. So many little people have been in it. But in my day, just the thinkers and sensitive people were there. And I loved it. I discovered things that would bring tears rolling down your cheeks. I discovered that I'd been screwed all along, and it wasn't my fault. An example I always use is that I was raised in a little town called Eau Claire, Wisconsin, in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. And around here, the Norwegian Lutheran Church isn't much, but there's the biggest church. And we were the majority, and it was just a great church, kind of a strict church, but a great church, and I loved it. We learned to sing in Norwegian sometimes, and we got catechized, and they only really had two main rules, as far as I could tell. You don't sin, and you don't monkey with Catholics. And that's okay. Makes for a good, easy life. And as I got old, it turned out I was weak, and I got sinning. Then I got monking with Catholics. Then I got sinning with Catholics. Practically repopulated the Catholic Church in North America. So I kind of knew I was going to go to hell, but it wasn't the church's fault. It was just that I needed a good time. And in psychoanalysis years later, I can't tell you what a shock it was when I found out the Norwegian Lutheran Church had repressed me, had left deep psychological scars. I was just sick about it, for Christ's sake. I couldn't believe it. If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. We probably could have hired a couple co-dependents and sat around and been pissed off every week. I discovered that I'd been repressed by the depression. Didn't even know there'd been a depression. I discovered all kinds of things. I just loved it. I'll tell you, I used to think a few years ago, when I was sober a few years, I used to think, why did I like psychoanalysis so much? You know, all I ever got there was bad news, and I was about my parents or about the depression or about this or that, and it cost me a lot of money, but I just couldn't wait to get there. I just loved it. And only the last 3 or 4 years have I had the glimmering of why I liked it. Now I understand quite well, because I've seen close up, sober, other therapies that provide the same service and why they are successful. And they really are successful. They have become very, very big, these therapies. And to understand what they do, it's necessary to understand, at least for people like me, I've been around AA a long time, and I've traveled all over the world, and I've seen AA. I know AA's everywhere. And last place I got to go is South Africa. I got to go there in April. So now I've been everywhere, I guess. But of all the alcoholics I know, whatever else they have when they come to AA, there's two things every alcoholic I know has had. You have to have a lack of self-worth, and you must have a deep-seated guilt. The reason for the guilt can vary. You never get different reasons for it, but it's always that guilt. And these are the type of deep-seated things you don't get rid of by talking about them. You can whitewash them, pretend they're gone, but the next time you're tired or cross, they're back. You don't get rid of them easily. They require a lot of work over a long period of time. And they require continual maintenance. Now, what would you do? What would you say if I told you there were therapies available now that will almost immediately rid you of deep-seated guilt? I have never known anything that will do that except alcohol, which is one of the reasons I drank it. But there are therapies, that's true, but there are therapies that will rid you of guilt now, which makes them tremendously successful. And do you know how they rid you of guilt? The same way psychoanalysis rid me of guilt. They asked me to accept the role of continuing victim, because when it's their fault, it is not my fault. No matter what I do, I was programmed this way. They didn't mean to do it, but they've ruined my life. And it's just terrible. And I'm a victim. And I'm sorry that I did those terrible things, but not my fault. I was just programmed that way. Now, what's wrong with that? To be able to get rid of guilt, that's a pretty nice deal, to get rid of guilt. I was in the 1950s, and they do it now in these therapies today. You come to understand as you get older, there's no free lunches. Everything there is that you get that's worth anything, you have to pay for. And there's a price for getting rid of guilt, but it doesn't have a big red tag on top. It's a hidden price. You discover it. Sometimes you don't even know until after you've paid it for 2 or 3 years. And that's this. In order to be a continual victim, in order to get the values of victimization, there are 3 major prices you pay. 1, whether you intend to or not, you little by little over a period of time must sustain and enhance your feelings of resentment toward those who have done it to you. If you ever see these therapies where people discuss that they're that way because of somebody else did to them, you stand outside the meeting afterwards and nobody ever comes out smiling because they've been there reinforcing the resentment. The second feeling that you get, you must, whether you intend it or not, you sustain it, is the feeling of difference. I can never really fit in because they or it has ruined my life or my inner child or my parents or whatever it might be has done this to me. And I could have been something, but they've made it impossible for me to do it. There's no sense even trying because it's too late. And the third price you pay is down deep, continual feeling of self-pity. I would have been a contender if it hadn't been for these things. I could have been something. I could have had a happy life. I would have had a happy marriage. I would have been a good father. But they ruined it all for me. Now, maybe that's not too big a price to pay to get rid of guilt, because guilt's a painful thing. But at least for people like me, and I presume like you if you're in the crowd, we have a blue book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says in there the three most lethal emotions for people like you and me: resentment, self-pity, and feelings of difference. Great many people in this organization have been led into those other therapies because it looks like they found the real answer we have never addressed. I'm a guy in our group named Chuck Barnes. I guess he doesn't mind if I use his name now. But he was sober 4 years and doing very well. And one of these people got a hold of him. Some woman got a hold of him and says, "You're wasting your time today. You should get to this therapy," which I will not name, but it's one we all heard of. And he went over there for 2 years. And he stopped going to meetings finally. I said, I called him up. I was his sponsor. I said, "Chuck, you ought to go to a meeting." She said, "I'm not going to drink. I'm, for the first time in my life, I'm finding the truth of what has been done to me." And about 6 months ago, he never did drink. But he found enough truth that he went home after one of their meetings and hanged himself. Sober as a judge. And he just discovered truth. And that form of truth is a lethal thing. Now, don't misunderstand me. I want to say one thing. As a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I realize my role. I have no feelings about what they do in their meetings. People want to go there, that's fine. I wish them well. I hope that every commercial ACOA meeting tonight is full of people. I mean, not the Al-Anon one, but the commercial one. I hope the Al-Anon ones are full of people because they're the ones where they're working the steps. I hope that every inner child meeting is full of people tonight. But I'll tell you this. I'll be damned if I ever want to go to an AA meeting and hear that crap talked about here. I no more want to hear about your inner child than I expect to go to their meeting and insist they read the 12 traditions. Different organizations, different therapeutics. This deals with recovery. They deal with continuing goddamn pain. And I don't judge them. But I tell you that if you want to go to them, fine. But you keep what you get there. I don't want to come into a meeting where there's 12 steps of recovery and actions to take to change my life and hear about some sick, neurotic tendency of yours that some goofy counselor who can't stay sober himself has told you. That's it. Happy days. I shouldn't get off on that, but I do, because I watch people around me really in deep trouble. But I was a victim for years in psychoanalysis. I loved it. I'll tell you another thing. You never really feel good again either. Victims never really feel good because they're always negative emotions going. But later on, I couldn't afford that anymore, and I got into metaphysics and did a lot of things. But the one thing that helped me the most over all my life was the one thing I never paid much attention to. I discovered when I was a little boy, 15 years old, full of either acute neurosis or a high excitement level, that I ran away from home and got to San Francisco and lied my age, was on a ship in the South Pacific. And the day before my 16th birthday, I was in Pearl Harbor early in the Second World War, and some men intimidated me into taking a drink of whiskey. And I tried to explain to them. I couldn't say because I choked up, but I thought at them, "But I'm a Lutheran." Lutherans don't drink whiskey. I promised my mother I wouldn't drink. Good guys don't drink whiskey. Buck Jones never drank whiskey. I was just about to tell him this, and I heard a voice say, "God damn right." And that's my voice. That's good. And I had my first drink of whiskey at that ship, and it burned my mouth, and it burned my throat, and burned my stomach, and burned my mouth, and burned his shirt, last I saw of it. It was just hideous. And what I remember about that is the scornful laughter. You know, the,
get the bottle away, you little son of a bitch.
No. I don't know of anything, any single emotion, that is more blindingly crazed than public humiliation for people like me, and I presume like some of you. So I'll just humiliate her and try it. Where do you think you're going, Missy? Mention my name, you'll get a good seat. Every time I talk, she walks in front of me and incites me to say terrible things. No hard feelings. But I really mean that. I don't. That's a terrible when you're inadequate and somebody publicly humiliates you. To this day, and it sounds strange, you may laugh at this, but the people I sponsor, I tell them I do not want them to own handguns. Because years ago, I remember watching two different AA guys in a fit of rage grab a gun and do something they wouldn't have done if they had to go to the next room to get it. Just that instant. That's why I don't. I tell the people I sponsor, I would prefer they didn't have any whiskey in the house or any booze in the house. Of course, the argument against that is, well, if you're going to drink, you're going to drink. That may be. But I've known one dear friends who were just doing fine, weren't going to drink at all. But one guy, in a beef with his wife in the next room, she ground him, and he ground back, and she finally said something that just made him crazy. He said, "You bitch!" Boom, boom. And that was the end of it for him. And if he'd had to go in the next room to get it, he wouldn't have done it. For people like me who are, when the right combination of buttons are pressed, who become momentarily crazed, I know one thing to avoid that, and that's to stay out of the situations where your buttons can be pressed. And if they are pressed, to not be in a position where you can ruin your life. But I had no tools to deal with these guys. They publicly humiliated me. I'd have killed them if I could, but I had no, you know. I thought later, the only thing I might have done, I might have said, "Lean over, fella."
"Yeah, what do you want?"
"Take that." Give him a zit right in the old eye, teach him a lesson. But I'll tell you, I felt terrible. So for the next few days when nobody was looking, I would sneak into this guy's sea bag and try to take a drink or two. And I hated it, but I finally held one down. And I held it down, and I just hated it. I suddenly realized, all of a sudden, I felt better than I had ever felt. We talked about that, and I felt for the first time the way men looked. Just wonderful. And I discovered that alcohol is a good thing. You know, there's a book out called All the Things I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. That's really a bunch of crap. I never learned anything in kindergarten. I didn't even learn to sleep on my rug, for Christ's sake. I just... You learn about life in your teens. That's when you learn about life. You learn about lust, and you learn about... I want anyone else to feel free to get up and leave anytime you want to. And she's my favorite, too, and I'm sitting next to her. Well, you learn in your teens, you learn about love, and you learn about drinking, and you learn about smoking, and you learn about relationships, and you learn your family is going to support you the rest of your life, and you learn about having to get along with people, and knowing they're to protect you sometimes. And that's when you learn about life. And you try to stick with the work things you like and get rid of the things you don't like. And drinking was something I learned along the way. No big deal. That's what men did, and I did it. I didn't become a crazed drunk throughout the Pacific. I tried to drink and learned to drink, and somebody got drunk, and it was fun, it was exciting, it was a whole different world. At the end of the war, I was up here in Pleasanton, Naval Hospital, and getting sewed together, and some gray lady came around with a bunch of tests. And I tell you, I've said this 1,000 times when I took this test, but only in the last couple of years have ever struck me what a miracle that was. Because she just gave out a bunch of tests to the guys in the hospital, or to some of us at any rate. And I've often thought about that, because I've always had kind of a perverse attitude some days. I'm just terrible. I could just as easily have said, "Oh, I'm not going to take your damn test. That's not part of being in the hospital. Screw off here with your Red Cross crap." Or I might have been in one of my cute moods and taken the test and made every answer wrong just to show how cute I was. But that day, I guess I wasn't feeling well, so I did it right. And I wrote it. I just happened to hit it right. And what's the big deal? 2 weeks later, she came by to me and a few others, not all the people, a few of us, and gave us our high school diplomas, the Armed Forces Institute. She said, "Congratulations, you did very well in your test." And so with that, that changed my life. Just I stopped thinking about that. If I hadn't taken that test, I'd have had to go back to start my junior year in high school after the war. There's no way I would have done that. Instead, I was able to go to college, which was people in my age group. I went to college after the war, and the first class of veterans, we all stood around the campus, tried to look like steely-eyed, sex-crazed killers. Wonder if our unemployment check would make it on time this week. I got married in college, out in the world, and became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer. But I married this Catholic girl who I'd never known a woman with dark hair before. And seemed more exotic to me. And she kept having babies, as is the want of Catholics. I tried to please, I thought about that. I used to please her, I said, can't we use birth control? And she said, no. And I thought about that later. What if she had said yes? What the hell would I have done? In my generation, nobody had the guts to go to a drugstore and order birth control. You know, God, it'd take some guy with cojones as big as a house in it. And the ones that did went in and said things like, hey, give me some cigarettes and some condoms. Now it's a little bit different, at least where I live. The guys walk into the thrifty drugs, they say, hey, give me some condoms and some cigarettes. Good. Good. But she had a priest come by one day and he gave me an hour and a half on the rhythm system, which is the Catholic version of birth control. And I listened intently and I just couldn't pick up that beat. I became a national distributor of small Catholics is what happened to me. And I was kind of successful. I got some big jobs, eventually in advertising, public relations. And all these years I drank. The only problem I ever had in my life, major problem, because drinking offset so much of this. I didn't identify at the time, but I'll tell you why drinking was important in my life. I discovered this long after so. Alcohol had the power to almost instantly take a person who didn't feel like they were enough and make me feel temporarily more than enough. Alcohol took a person like me who lived with fear, and for a while I was fearless. Alcohol took a person like me who was always subject to rejection and hurt feelings, and I became momentarily omnipotent. I'm sure some of you, the example I always take, some of you guys have had this experience. Sitting in a bar late at night, having a few drinks, watching the miracle of alcohol take place, watching some old beast become beautiful. And I might sidle over to such an old queen and imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension. She'd like to join me in the old Chevy. Now, she would say, now, when I'm drinking, I don't feel rejected. I don't know what I'd do if I was sober, because I wouldn't be dare ask the question if I was sober. If I did, I'd hang myself, I suppose. But when I have a few drinks, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her, you know. Don't come begging tomorrow, bitch. That's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. And sometimes, unfortunately, I drink too much. Sometimes I get drunk. Sometimes, as I like to say, many times I've been thoughtlessly overserved. That happens a lot to victims. And when I get drunk sometimes, I act bizarre. I didn't know why that was until I got in psychoanalysis, but I realized in psychoanalysis that I've been repressed all my life. And there are chains of the psyche holding me down. And alcohol dissolves these chains, at least temporarily. And I'm free, and I sometimes frighten people around me. I never could get a cop to buy that, but I got it. So I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. Most of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. Now, 22 is not terribly young in AA today, but then no one heard of anybody within 15 years of it. That's it. They just thought I was a little freak, and I thought they were old freaks. And I had a terrible time. I didn't last long. And I would have left soon after that. I was in psychoanalysis and other things. And every so often, I would go back to AA. Somebody would send me back to AA. So I went to AA off and on for the next years. But I went to real therapies most of the time. And so, as I do now when I talk, I've done this before and I'll do it again because I think there's always young people and new people here. I think sometimes we get so caught up in our AA life today that we don't tell you We are not reminded of the valuable role you play. Now, my home group, some of you have been there. Some of you were there last Wednesday night. Biggest group in the world, 1,100 people. Just a big, exciting, all everybody dresses well and they look well. And the guys off Skid Row look good. Everybody just looks good. And we have a lot of young people in that group. I'll tell you the young people in this meeting tonight. If you are like the young people in our group, I want to remind you, you are the AA leaders of tomorrow. If you're like the young people in our group, I'll tell you something else. I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. Idiots. Dumbbells. Nothing personal. My sponsor told me that 30 years ago, and he's glad he's dead. But I went to therapy, did a lot of things. But alcohol is the best friend I ever had. That probably sounds terrible if you're new at an AA meeting to hear somebody get up and say that. But to this day, I'm offended when I hear people get up and say things like, "That damn alcohol! It was poison from the first drink." It's like hearing somebody badmouth an old girlfriend of mine. Hey, wait a minute. She may be a pig now, but she didn't used to be. By God, I'm loyal. And I drank, and I used alcohol to get me through things. Alcohol, I'm sure some of you have the experience too. I have, all my life, I never was worth a damn at small talk. I always hate situations where I'm going to be small talk. Now I was in public relations. And going to parties, and when you're sober, standing around, and, you know, well, going to be a scorcher tomorrow, huh? Sometimes you can get your courage up and say things like, "Say the woman in the red dress, is she a beast?" Oh, that's your wife, huh? Going to be a scorcher tomorrow. When I have a few drinks, I go to Algonquin Round Table, baby. I get too hip for the room. I just... And I've stopped drinking from time to time when people thought my problem was alcohol. Well-meaning people, but I know it isn't. Because it's just, when I stop drinking, all it does, there's a little moment of elation when I've made this decision. And one night, my old pals come back to visit me in the middle of the night. Here comes fear and loneliness, feelings of difference, feelings of resentment, feelings of self-pity, and all the things that, when they come, it's going to be long. You're going to be sober long now, folks. And the day finally came, I became somewhat successful, though. And I got to be successful several times and had an unfortunate series of, seemed to me, just coincidences. Every job wound up with a quit with hurt feelings or fired because of some emotional explosion or drunk and getting in trouble and on and on and on. Everybody says, "You have such potential, you did so good, but there's something wrong with you." They didn't say there's something wrong with you, but we can't have you here. And the day finally came in my life that cannot come to a person with my background and intelligence and experience. One morning I found myself being physically thrown out of a Skid Row mission. And the guy said, "And stay out." And I tried to explain to him, "I'm not a bum. 3 years ago I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the L.C. Nelmer ads for the Borden Company. If you're old, you remember them, all those cows talking to each other. Now you can laugh, but it's the only thing that ever was successful for the Borden Company, really. And in 1993, they're going to go back to the L.C. Nelmer, the cows, their stature symbol. Write those things. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement." How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. You know, you just... And unfortunately, I'd had my front teeth kicked out about a month before that in the Phoenix jail. So I wasn't hitting those confidence by singing. I should say in passing, I remember that morning, I'm probably going to talk a little bit too long tonight, but there's nothing else to do. But I remember waking up in the Phoenix jail and waking up and finding a guy, I was laying on the floor and the guy was kicking my front teeth out of my throat. He said, "You vomited on my bunk, you drunken son of a bitch." Smack. "You laughing at that? Wait till I get to the part where I get leukemia. You like that?"
But anyway, I woke up and I was one of the few mornings I was glad that I had been in psychoanalysis. I was glad I'd been in psychoanalysis because once you've been in psychoanalysis, you have insights and understandings that most people don't have. I was so sick I couldn't even move my head out of the way of his shoe while he kicked my teeth out, but I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. That cheers you up a little. When I stood outside of the Skid Row Mission in downtown Los Angeles in an old shirt and an old pair of jacket that was kind of half torn, some pants, I'd lost my clothes somewhere. I'd lost, my family had gone away, my children were gone, my parents had ripped me off. I was, as far as I could see, I was just about dying on the street. And the guy came up, if a guy would have come up to me and said, answer the question honestly, kid, we'll save your life. Are you an alcoholic? To save my life, but I had to say, no, I'm not, but I wish I were. I wish I were. I wish my life were that uncomplicated. I wish I could be like these AA members who stop drinking and clean up their act and they feel better. There's something much deeper than that in my life. And I walked 71 blocks out to an AA club because it was raining. I'd been asked to leave a week before. Hung around that damn club. It was terrible. I slept in the back seat of a man in the car. As I mentioned, that's why I wanted to get to UCLA to get some square meal. And and the club was full of the worst type of people that an intelligent slipper can be around. And these people are called AA fanatics. God, they're a grisly bunch. You know, you just, when you're cursed with intelligence, you just, you try to get a little ploy to get something going for you. So, you know, I don't have anything left anymore. I've lost my home and my family, but I used to be quite successful. If I have a few dollars, I probably could get started again. And they give you answers like, go to a lot of meetings, work the steps. It'll all get better. Really. And I hung around that damn club. And I'd been in and out of AA for many years by then. I knew more, a lot about AA. I did a lot of things. I'll tell you what happened. They did the same thing as they do now. Get a sponsor, get a sponsor. I saw this actor who'd been in and out of the meetings, and he always played loving, kindly roles in the movies, so I thought, I'll ask him to be my sponsor. Maybe he could sponsor me for a few bucks and get some front teeth and get out of here. But every kindly role, he should have won the Academy Award for, because he was not a kindly man, and he intimidated me, and I used to hate that guy. I mean, I hated him, but somehow, I look back on that now. Why didn't I tell him to go screw himself and leave me alone? Because, you know, they can talk all they want about dictator sponsors. I'm known as a dictator sponsor in my area. But sponsors can never be dictators unless you have the complete acceptance of the dictatee. You know, we don't have any police force. We should. But, you know, if you guys want to sick of your sponsor, you say, screw you. I always thought it'd be nice if just a little force came to the house at night and said, we're from AA. Did you say screw you to your sponsor? Do you still have relatives in Akron? But he was a dictator type sponsor. And I often wonder, why did I let this guy dictate to me? And I look back, there are two factors. One factor is kind of abstract, is that I believe now, a guy who is on the kind of scam, who knows he's phony and goofy and bad, trying to put up a front, I hate people who can see through me, but I have a begrudging respect for them. I love people who I can fool, but I have no respect for them. And somehow he just pulled my covers when he talked to me. Hated him. I used to lie awake and think about it. Hate him. Respected him. He was not. He was telling me the truth, and as much as I hated him. And I was one of the factors. The other factor was, I apparently, without being aware of it, gotten to a point that I'd gotten to before, I didn't have the other factors with it. And that is, it's an amazing thing. Alcoholism, the alcoholic, nearly always must drink again because of the pain of sobriety. And this pain makes it imperative to drink or sedate. Somehow, here, if you can find the situation right. The desperation and the pain, the same desperation and pain that ensures you must drink, if you can allow someone to steer that, they will use that same desperation and pain to make you take actions that you would never take in 1,000 years on your own. Just like I'm thinking today, landing the plane coming out of San Jose today. The same engines that made us go 550 miles an hour on the way up here stopped us at the air. They just changed the direction of the thrust. And in a sense, to me, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. I'll tell you, I'd go around, as I told you a lot, around AA. And there, throughout AA, all over the world, there are pockets of enthusiasm, followed by big areas of kind of blah, just staying sober. Then another pocket of enthusiasm. And you see this all over the world. Anytime you see a pocket of enthusiasm, you will see a strong sponsorship ethic. And the reason for that is people have gotten into an ethic where they allow someone to use that pain to steer them to take actions rather than sit back and say, I'm not going to do that, I don't believe that, or I'll do it someday. But he made me take actions and do things. And some days I was almost suicidal. And you take that pain to me. I got fired as a dishwasher when I was 6 months sober after working 3 days in the job. And I was going to kill myself. And I called him up and he used that pain to curse me into writing an inventory. And I told him, I don't have to write an inventory. I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why should I take it with an out-of-work actor, for Christ's sake? I don't know why he didn't like me. But he cursed me into writing an inventory. And a week later, I took a fifth sip, something I swore I'd never do. He drove along the ocean all the way to Oxnard, 40 miles, to give me in the night, and I got a flashlight. And I read this hideous goddamn thing. I thought he's going to throw me out of the car. And I got near Oxnard, and I looked over, and he's going. I thought I'd broken him. But I've taken that trip maybe 225 times since then, on the driver's side. And some other boob over there. And the only time you come alert is when you think there may be something interesting coming out, and they say things like, oh, let me explain this part before I read it. But there's nothing ever new in an inventory, and once you've been listening to a few of them, the only thing that's new to is the guy taking it. That's what's so sad. That's why he needs all the help he can get to momentarily drive him to do it. Because there's nothing new in it. I tell you, I've heard been in many inventories as anybody in the world, I'll bet. And I haven't heard anything new in 20 years. In fact, after a while, they follow some patterns. You can almost tell when something's been left out. You know, didn't you leave something out there? You've been talking to that bitch? No, just that's what comes next there. The specifics vary, but it's always the same emotions. And I let him intimidate me, and little by little I felt better. One day, he had me start making amends. And of all the people to make amends to, he had me start making amends to my father, the man who led my list of resentments as the man who had victimized me all my life. And I said, for Christ's sake, he ruined my life! That may be, but you were a bad son too. We're going to start doing what you did. And over a period of time, oddly enough, my father and I corresponded a little bit, and I just hated it. My sponsor made me do everything. And one day, I talked to him. I was back here, and little by little, my stepmother died. We sat up all night talking, and the weirdest thing, he told me how our relationship had looked to him. And it looked to him as though I'd victimized him. Damn, I couldn't believe it. But we started to get along better after that. In the last 20 years of his life, we probably were closer than most fathers and sons in the whole world. When he died, he was holding my hand up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I'd flown up there. A couple of days later, we were sitting at the Norwegian Lutheran Church, about this size, full of people. And I was sitting by his casket. I was looking around the room thinking, isn't that marvelous? I'm glad my dad died out of the pain. I'm glad that AA has driven me to take actions to realize that the same God is in this church as is in my meeting in West L.A. And that God loves me and wants good things for me. And just think, I never would have known that. And the reason I mention that, because of this. If I had have stayed in the victimization philosophy rather than the AA recovery, to this day when people said, how was your father? I'd have said, I don't want to talk about that dirty son of a bitch. He ruined my life. And I said, now people say, how was your father? I say, sure glad he was my dad. And we had a lot of time, good time together. That's the difference. I don't want to live with the kind of pain of
called truth that eats you up inside. I wanted to live with peace with the world. But little by little I took the steps and finally held a job wrapping packages. Now I was a year sober. Not much of a job, but I held a job. And I was 2 years sober. I got a little job as a writer in a medical corporation. I went to work every day, so I was 5 years sober. I was director of advertising. When I was 2 years sober, I squirreled away some money. I said, Bob, I've got enough money to get some front teeth. Where'd you get the money? I said, I kind of put it aside. So why don't you send that money to your kids in Texas? They need it. I said, Jesus, Bob. They all got front teeth. I got a picture right here. I said, you're a crappy father. Send the goddamn money. Okay. So I learned to carry my lip like this. A lot of people never knew I didn't have front teeth. They just thought I'd been burned in a fire. When I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that corporation. I had front teeth then, I'll tell you. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio, became the number one hard rock station in the world. We all wore shiny suits, and said things like, what's coming on down, baby? Then I got into television, and then in public relations with oil companies. Then I was a marketing director for a big publishing firm. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife, all those children, heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, Texas, to a post office box. Leaped out of their post office box. Fled to my side. Attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. People say, why don't you have any hair in front? Do you know how many times I've said, you're what? But they've all grown up down there, all doing well. My oldest daughter's a DA in Albuquerque. She says to me last Christmas, she says, you know, Dad, when we were little girls, you made us go to our room. I said, yeah, honey, just to help me in Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. I guess she's kidding, but I didn't lose nothing in Albuquerque. But it's all nice. All very nice to her. And here I am tonight, sober, insane, and morning, I left a little house up by the ocean in Los Angeles, and a woman I've been married to for 43 years, and well, she's been married 43 years, I've been married 18, 19. Fault warped as a child. But the kids all grown up, got 10 grandchildren, one's working at MTV in New York now, doing Slick, and it's all very nice. There's only one thing that, if you're new tonight or having a problem with the program, you know you're going to get sick of these thinking success stories. You know, you'll discover after a while, no matter how sad they make their story, how tragic it is, how much they've lost, sooner or later, before the Lord's Prayer, they're going to say, but then, one day I walked through that door and the desire to drink left me instantly. I now have $10 million with me tonight. Several different families have returned to me. And I owed all the one thing. I put the plug in the jug. I think, hey, after a while, you don't even want to listen because you're sitting there thinking, which hurts least, cutting your wrists or hanging yourself? I think AA speakers would be listened to a lot more clearly, more thoroughly, if we'd ever so often throw a speaker in and say something like, and then it turned out, God damn it, I just couldn't make it. That's the way it is in the real world out there, boy. You don't know you're going to make it. I want to say one thing quickly. Now, I know I don't want to really keep you awake too long, but the most important thing I want to say tonight, or I'll say before I sit down, I said a long time ago, nobody paid any attention. And the old timers all know this, so they can doze off. I'm talking to the people who are new or who are weak and heavy laden tonight. You can be sober a lot of years and have go through periods of being weak and heavy laden. The most important thing I said tonight, I said, my name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. How in the world can I be an alcoholic? My problem never really was alcohol. It was temporarily that I was drunk. But it wasn't really alcohol. When I drank, it wasn't really alcohol the day I got sober, and it certainly hasn't been alcohol ever since. How can I be an alcoholic? How can you be an alcoholic if your problem really isn't alcohol? I'm going to tell you something. I'm glad that I fell into the hands of activists. I'm glad that I was desperate and full of pain and from time to time allowed them to steer that pain before I killed myself. I'm glad that I survived long enough to discover the most important single thing I have ever learned in my life about anything. And everything I've said tonight is just an introduction to this one sentence. If you're new tonight, remember this. I had to learn in AA. If my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. And conversely, if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not and cannot be alcohol. Now, doesn't that sound strange and upside down and crazy, like some kind of a fringe alternative therapy? But I guarantee you that's the message of AA as far as I know. That's the message of this book. I'm sure I'm one of the very few people in this room, maybe the only one, who sat and talked to Bill Wilson about it for an hour. That's what he thought. At least in 1963 when I sat in his office in New York. I don't think he changed his mind after that. Well, you say, but it must be alcohol. How can you tell? I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Hospitals turn out recovered people. Treatment centers turn out recovered people. Jails turn out recovered people. They don't. They turn out people who are physically sober with varying amounts of information. What may be wrong with it, but I'll guarantee you, if they be like me, or I presume like you, unless something dramatic happens after that, sooner or later, they must always eventually drink or sedate. Well, if it isn't alcohol, what is it? Something mysterious they're not telling us about? You got to pay more to get, like in these other therapies, you send us for buy some more books, you get to another week-long seminar? No. Something you hear about every day. Something you read about every day. Something you, every time you go to a meeting, you hear it at length. But if you are like me, your preconception of the word may be so strong it'll block out what it means, and that may cause you to die from it. But it is not alcohol. It is something called alcoholism. Listen, same thing. Alcohol, alcoholism, same thing. Not the same thing. Tremendous difference. I'll guarantee you, if you be like me, the day will come when your sanity and your life will depend on the difference. Well, what is the difference? I could give you an hour-long talk on that if I wanted to. A few years ago, I was invited to come to Orlando, Florida, to talk to the American College of Psychiatry winter meeting on the differences between alcohol problems and the disease of alcoholism. And when they called me on the phone, they said they'd fly me down first class. And I really felt kind of guilty at that. I could tell them on the phone, you know, what? Then I thought, if I do this, I'll never get to Disney World. I may not have had a happy childhood, but I've had a long one. It just I hear people talking about their inner child. I have an inner adult trying to get out. You better hurry, I'll tell you. But I mean, very seriously, you know what the difference is? The difference is this. Alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking, cleaning up your act, and living better. A strange, denigrating, destructive, emotionally eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking, cleaning up your act, living better, has no long-term significant effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't. The thing that makes alcoholism a fatal illness is not that you can't get the patient sober or educated, it is that the pain of sobriety eventually always gets worse than the remembered pain of drinking. So, but even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. That almost makes you an alcoholic. One other thing must be present. You must be one of the 5 or 6% of people in the world, and nobody knows why, but it seems to hold true in every generation, who gets an unnatural reaction from alcohol and never even knows it. Because you don't have nothing to compare it against. But this unnatural reaction to alcohol, this so-called allergy, this ultra-sensitivity. The question is, if you can find out what that is, then maybe you can make an intelligent judgment. Well, is it you stay drunk all the time? You hear these speakers say, I stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years. Tell you a medical fact. It is physically impossible for a human body to stay intoxicated 2 straight weeks, night and day, in a laboratory. That isn't it. Can't make you act crazy. Some people do. Some people don't. We hear a lot of speakers in AA who have crazy stories because it makes for interesting talks, but it has nothing to do with alcoholism. I'm in a different position than most of you. This morning I was in a situation where I was watching an alcoholic die in front of me. Monday I was in a situation where I watched an alcoholic die. Part of my job is watching alcoholics die today. Some of them have never acted crazy once. They get more and more catatonic. They get just more and more quiet. I was able to hold a mirror to their mouth. So it isn't that you're crazy. Is it that you can't handle alcohol? No. Alcoholics handle alcohol better than non-alcoholics in any kind of a test. Then what is it? And it turns out the unnatural reaction is something so simple I never would have guessed it in 10,000 years. Do you know what the unnatural reaction must be? It's had the unnatural ability of almost instantly making everything all right. I think that's such a big thing. But it turns out it doesn't do that for most people. They call it an immediate alteration of my perception of reality, an alteration of my relationship to my environment, an enhancement of my stature and omnipotence, a decreasing of their threat to me. Whatever it may be, it just boils down to this. It makes me feel all right. I remember my sponsor telling me that years ago when I was new. He said, remember this, kid? For them, alcohol goes blah, blah, blah. But for you and me, it goes boom. That's why we're here and they're not. I said, yeah, that's really good, Bob. All right, bed down. But to this night, that's still the best test I know. If you're a new one, though, here's the test. Of course, we have 20 questions. We have 40 questions. Hazelden's got an 8,000-page book. If you're not an alcoholic when you start, you are and you're done. But the best test I know is this. Just to visualize to yourself that another day is here where your back's to the wall and the hounds of fate ripping at your throat and every man's hand is turned against you and somebody says, here, have a drink. And you say, oh, thanks. Would you really be satisfied to have it go? No more for me. I'm starting to feel it. It's hard to remember. That's the reaction most people get. That's why they don't drink. They will never know what you and I take for granted. When your back's to the wall and the hounds of fate ripping at your throat and every man's hand says, have a drink. It doesn't go. It goes. You want to try me, copper? Hey, Mr. Carlson, you know that job I worked 6 months to get? Shove it. You with anyone, Granny? Alcohol must have the power to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. And if it does that, it's wonderful. But to quickly jump why it's wrong is because sooner or later, if it does that for you, it has a little tendency to erode your ability to cope with reality. Because you don't have to work through problems anymore. You can change them. And one day, alcohol becomes a problem. And then you're going to stop drinking. So you stop drinking and realize it's really painful to stop drinking. So I'll watch it, I'll control it. And you start. But you can't stay drinking, so you got to stop. But you can't stay sober, so you got to start. But you can't stay drinking, so you got to stop. To give the first step, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and also that our lives had become unmanageable, sober and drunk. And you read this funny little thing in chapter 3 where they talk about things people have done. Sworn off with or without a solemn oath, change from scotch to brandy, drink beer only, drink at home only, never drink at home, on and on. Funny little things. Why do people get into that? Because of a very simple reason. I've discovered I can't stand it sober, and drinking is a big problem. I got to find it. And when you get into that solution, when you get into that problem, that's called alcoholism. And today in America, with all the help available, AA, treatment centers, hospitals, counselors, over 95% of alcoholics still die drunk or die as a direct result of drinking. And I'll tell you, as far as I'm concerned, they die saying the same thing. But you don't understand. I am not really an alcoholic. I went to AA and I went to treatment and all these things. But my problem isn't alcohol. I have these terrible feelings. I drank to get some relief, for Christ's sake, and now I drink a little too much and you think my problem is alcohol. They have just defined the disease of alcoholism. The reason that's important to remember that, so you won't sit in AA meetings and go to a few meetings and talk the talk and giggle and go to a bar and, or a coffee shop and wonder why you feel bad. The natural state of sober alcoholics is growing depression and anxiety. I would suggest if AA is not working for you, that you find someone to steer your pain into taking the actions that your mind will not let you take on your own. You get involved in taking steps that don't seem to have any application in your life until after you take them. You make some degrees of continual surrender, remembering, I don't like these things, but I don't have to like them. What I can't stand is what I become. And little by little, AA works. You wonder what AA does for you as you're rich or famous? Some people do, some people don't. The most happy people I know, a woman I sponsor is 22 years sober. She's become the best waitress in her restaurant. She's happy as a clam, has been for years. And she, I'll tell you what AA does. In my opinion, AA very slowly does what alcohol does fast. Over a period of time, it very slowly takes people who feel like they're not enough and makes me feel like I'm enough. Not all the time, because human beings don't feel like they're enough all the time. It takes a person like me living with fear, and most of the time I don't have fear. It takes a person like me who lives with hurt feelings, the time I've... Point of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's people, it's places. It's not to make you wonderful, not to make you holy, not to make you any of these things. Little by little, fill holes that only alcohol has ever filled before. And I know it works because it works for me. The last thing I want to say before I sit down. AA today, as forever, as far back as I can remember, 1949, there's around AA, there's always kind of this circling of jackals, like they circle the buffalo herd, waiting for a sick buffalo so they can jump on it. And these people come around and they say, hey, listen, AA is good for your drinking, but if you have really deep emotional problems, AA isn't enough. You need more than this. Maybe you need this therapist. Maybe you need Prozac. Maybe you need deep feelings. Maybe you need to discover your inner child. Maybe you need on and on, all these things. If you don't do that, you can't possibly survive because AA only deals with your drinking. You're emotionally troubled. Let me just say this. In my lifetime, I have been in jail 33 times, which is not a world record, but it's good for an advertising executive. I have been in a veterans hospital twice, once in a padded cell. I've been chained down in the municipal hospital where my wife came in, went upstairs, had a baby, and went home again, and I was still chained down. I have been committed to spend an indefinite period up to the rest of my life to the Texas State Insane Asylum, Big Spring, Texas, as a sober suicide. I think I can speak on behalf of the people with strong emotions. Speaking on behalf of the people with strong emotions, let me say this. Despite what anybody tells you, Alcoholics Anonymous, its people, its fellowship, its program, its steps, will work at least 34 and a half years. I know that from personal experience. Think of a love offering, dummy. It'll work 34 and a half years, and it'll make you feel good, and it'll make you feel better than all the people who tell you it doesn't work. So if you're new tonight, or afraid, or lonely, or sad, give it all you got. End of 34 and a half years. If you're not happy, come back here. I won't be here to listen to it. So